guns and money.
Welcome back, everybody, to episode... we're already 60-plus episodes into Conduct Detrimental. Am I going to keep doing this when we get into the 100s, 200s, 300s? Welcome to episode 1,321. Okay, we're far enough along in the continuum I could dispense with that. So welcome to the Sports Law Podcast, Conduct Detrimental. I'm your co-host, Daniel Wallach, and with me, as always, is... Sports Law Lust, Dan Lust, my co-host. Dan, how are you? How are you today?
We're just going to break tradition. We're going to break tradition. We're just not going to do it. You know what, Dan? Wild card. It's the Roger Maris episode. It's episode 61. How about that, Dan? How you like them apples?
That's an excellent one because I didn't have a New York Giant that necessarily fit into 61. Maybe it was Bart Oates. I can't remember. But eventually, as we get into triple figures, the uniform number isn't going to really work, and I think we're going to run out of really good topic or really good, you know, I guess, analogies or reference points in sports. So let's just say Conduct Detrimental is the Sports Law Podcast, and we're back as always. So Dan, we're going to change things up this week. You and I are notorious for being generalists and specialists on so many different topics in a given week, but this week, we're going to train our focus on one case, one issue, and see if that might be a more interesting way to approach Conduct Detrimental, at least for one week. Would you like to clue our audience into what this week's topic is?
Yeah, first of all, I don't like that you switch these things up on me, okay? Listen, this is not, just kidding. Obviously, we planned this out. So for those coming anew to Conduct Detrimental, we normally cover a handful of the biggest stories of the week. But this week, for better or for worse, we're blessed with really one story that I've been covering kind of behind the scenes, but now it's kind of in the spotlight this week. And otherwise, it's not a college football week. We just have one story. So without further
ado. Thank God.
Let's not thank God. Some of us like college football over here.
Oh my God. So yeah. Big Ten. We're finally moving on.
So, well, let's jump right into it. The story is near and dear to a lot of us. It's the, we'll say the Vanessa Bryant, we'll say trilogy of lawsuits, trilogy of legal actions. Just a brief background. So not to bury the lead, we're going to talk about Vanessa Bryant's lawsuit against the LA County Sheriff's Office, a lawsuit filed in the last couple of days, depending on when you're listening to this. It's early in the week of September 21st. We're going to get into that, but you really to understand where that lawsuit comes from, you need a little bit of a background on the tragic passing of Kobe Bryant, the memorial, and the underlying wrongful death lawsuit, along with some federal legislation. So between Dan and myself, we're going to lay a little bit of foundation, and then in the last half of this podcast, last two-thirds, however long it takes us to get through the background, we're just going to break down the legalese, as they say. So Dan, let me kick it to you to start. Just tell me, it can be legal, non-legal. What are your overall thoughts on, Kobe, Vanessa, Gianna, and where we all start?
Well, I mean, the emotions are still raw. The news is still relatively recent. And the optic of Vanessa Bryant suing anybody in Los Angeles County has to send a chill down any defendant's spine. I mean, how would you like to be the sheriff's office, one of the sheriff's deputies, or any defendant being on the other side of the V against Vanessa Bryant in a case that arises out of the tragic death of Kobe Bryant? So right away on a gut level or just a high level impression that this is really difficult terrain for any defendant, because he was such a beloved and remains such a beloved figure, not only in the world of professional basketball, but particularly, especially in Los Angeles. So it does raise issues of, no matter what the merits of this case are, or what the merits of any of these cases, the defendants, whether it's the helicopter company, the deceased pilot, or in this case, Los Angeles County or the sheriff's office, they're really facing a powerful adversary in terms of home court advantage. And the home court advantage doesn't lie with Los Angeles County or with the sheriff's office. The sympathies and the emotions lie with Vanessa Bryant, and that's going to loom over all of these cases.
Yeah, I mean, so I guess we'll just do a brief chronology just so people understand the time frame here. Kobe's passing, the helicopter crash, I remember, I've talked about this, but, you know, the kind of watershed moment, you know, where you were when it happened, January 26, 2020, right before this COVID madness kind of hit, it set the tone for, we'll say what's been a somber and otherwise, a strange 2020, to say the least. But I remember thinking it was fake and then, you know, sadly finding out it was real. Within a month of that loss, within the months of that incident, on February 24th, 2020, Vanessa Bryant files her wrongful death lawsuit. That was the same, February 24th. You know, people will know that was the date of the memorial, but the reason that was picked as the date of Kobe and Gianna's memorial, Gianna obviously being, Kobe's daughter. Kobe, we knew him as number eight for a little bit, then we knew him as number 24. And Gianna's number for the Mamba Academy, the black jersey, was number two. So 224 was very fittingly a day that made sense for this memorial. So on that day, a mega wrongful death complaint was filed. Dan, maybe you want to give a little bit of your impressions on the content and what this complaint looked like as you went through it.
Well, I'm still reading it, Dan. The lawsuit was filed almost a half a year ago. And it's really daunting in its scope, length. I think it's 286 paragraphs, 28 separate causes of action. It's a 70-page complaint for basically a state court, state law, wrongful death action. And in my business, in my neck of the woods, when we've done civil defense work, whether or plaintiff side work in any kind of wrongful death scenario, most of the complaints in state court tend to be on the shorter side. In federal court, there's a heightened pleading allegation, and then the complaint allegations tend to be much more comprehensive than they are in state court, where only a short and plain statement is really required. So what struck me about the lawsuit was just its scope, its depth, and it really does show or showcase what is likely to be an aggressive litigation strategy going forward. I mean, she's being represented by one of the biggest law firms in California, Munger, Tolles and Olson. Mm-hmm. So I think the when you look at the complaint, when you weigh the complaint and see who the attorneys are, it's like, wow, look at, if you're the defense lawyer or the defendants in the case, you're up against a very formidable opponent that's not going to spare any expense and has the sympathies of Los Angeles County on her side.
Yeah, so I think just to Dan's point, it is not, in addition to wrongful death complaints, I mean, I've defended my fair share of wrongful death lawsuits. They're, we'll say for better or for worse, attorneys will use the same, at least in New York, same general template. They'll change a couple things around. They want to make sure they hit, facial sufficiency and they hit the right tones, the right tenors. But it's going to be the same basically cut and paste job. I don't mean to say anything bad about plaintiff's lawyers, but there's no necessarily need to unveil and reveal your hand in a complaint. You do that later on in the bill of particulars or during depositions, but you don't do it during the complaint. Now, in the state of California, where this accident, where the incident occurred, there's a 2-year statute of limitations on the filing of a case. So that means from the date of someone's passing, you have 2 years to file a lawsuit. So here, that would have put the statute of limitations firmly January 26th of 2022. So again, typically in these instances, you would wait. If you're the plaintiff, you would wait until, maybe a year, year and a half, a little bit closer to that deadline. Because once you put a case into suit, the court has their own what's called standards and goals, which basically says, these courts are judged, and it's maybe, I'm not sure if this is news to everybody, but judges have a scorecard of how fast they're adjudicating cases. That's why if you go to court and the judge adjourns it, it might be nice that the judge adjourns it, he's going to postpone it, but the longer a case goes on and past a certain window, so judges, when a case is assigned, usually if it's either a complex case or a standard case, we'll say they'll get like 2.5 years from their bosses to get a case done. If it's a really complex case, like this one probably is, maybe they'll get 3.5 years or something like that. Some number, three, maybe, I don't want to say 3.5, but it starts the clock ticking, right? So there's no reason you want to start the clock ticking and while these investigations are still going on, right? While they're investigating, the NTSB is investigating, or the FAA is investigating, or there's, they're looking for the black box and whatnot. So really atypical to file a lawsuit within a month of someone passing away. In addition, Dan, we're not even talking about it. there's got to be a natural grieving process that occurs. And to file a lawsuit within a month of losing your husband, the father of your children, I wouldn't have, you know, Dan, you know, I'm a betting man. I would not have bet on that. That is not something that I would have thought would have occurred here. So anyway, we point this out, you know, you guys turn in for the sports law analysis. We have a wrongful death complaint. Is it necessarily in the sports law intersection? Sure. I mean, maybe, but we have to understand how impressive it is that such a massive complaint is filed within, you know, within 30 days.
Yeah, I mean, I want to build on that point by agreeing with you that just generally speaking, it does raise eyebrows that during what should be a normal grieving process, litigation has commenced. But this is these are not normal circumstances. And I think in Vanessa Bryant's case, there was a real advantage in filing the lawsuit sooner rather than later, because, you know, the news this was a worldwide story. It received a tremendous amount of attention. There seems to be, at least in many people's minds, a clearly an indisputably damaged, plaintiff. And by most in most people's lenses, the perception that something went wrong here, that this wasn't, you know, a normal accident or an act of God. Somebody was at fault, the helicopter pilot or the manufacturer of the helicopter or the owner of the helicopter. So there's a real tactical advantage, I think, in striking while the iron's hot. And let's make no mistake about the grieving process here. And you know, this is not Vanessa Bryant burning the midnight oil, drafting a complaint when she should be grieving. The only effort her part was to sign an engagement letter with a law firm, and the law firm did the rest of the work. So it doesn't exactly cause a distraction or interfere with the grieving process. And I think this was definitely the kind of case where you want to move quicker instead of, you know, laying back and waiting on the statute of limitations and filing it maybe a week before the statute of limitations runs out. I mean, justice delayed is justice denied. And there's a real advantage, as I've just said, in moving expeditiously on the heels of this, you know, traumatic event, which is still fresh in everybody's minds.
Yeah. So let's, we'll kind of go over the highlights, but I do want to make sure we get to the LA County Sheriff's case. That's obviously the new news we have today. The lawsuit importantly is alleged against the helicopter pilot as well as the helicopter company. It does not include the manufacturers and, The Kobe Bryant is not listed as a defendant, even though it sounds crazy. I have seen a case where, a family member sues an operator of a car, even though, you know, husband sues wife just because one was driving. That's sometimes what you do with insurance policies, or a son sues a father if the father was driving. It doesn't matter if they lived or passed away. It's kind of an insurance technicality. But Kobe's was not named in the estate, in the case. Why would Kobe possibly be named? You've seen it online. I don't know if there's any necessarily truth to this, but there's allegations that Kobe, you know, this is also obviously speculation. There's no black box in the plane. Nothing like that was recovered. But that maybe Kobe was telling them to fly, and he was rushing them, and he's the organizer of the flight. So he maybe had a supervisory role when it came to, this flight that, maybe Kobe should have possibly said something. So I don't know if I buy that. But importantly, for legal purposes, when you're a plaintiff, right, and you're trying to get as much money as you can from a lawsuit, obviously Vanessa Bryant's not going to sue Kobe Bryant. That just doesn't make sense. But Vanessa Bryant sued first. The other family members have followed. If you were another family member and you're trying to make sure you have the most money, right, some of these families, you know, some of the passengers were husband and wife, right? So children are left parentless. It's tragic. As much as you don't want to sue Kobe Bryant, you know, when he passed away, Forbes estimated his worth to be about $600 million. So not putting Kobe Bryant in the lawsuit when there's maybe even a scintilla of fault on his part, it's interesting at least. But, you know, no Kobe Bryant named. Kobe Bryant has not, you know, you can always obviously amend the complaint to add Kobe if something came up. He has not been added to this point. So just a quick, Dan, let me ask you, do you find it weird that Kobe was A, not included, and B, hasn't been amended or anything like that?
Yeah, I mean, among other things, you for the reasons you pointed out, but I'm also surprised by the lack of attention that's been placed on the other seven victims. I mean, this is not a case only about, you know, Kobe Bryant and Vanessa Bryant. There were seven other people who perished. So, there's only a finite amount of money to go around. I mean, no defendant is so deep pocketed that everyone is going to be receiving an eight-figure settlement here. And it really does place the plaintiffs almost at, in conflict with one another, because they're not, while they have a unity of interest, at least in terms of the legal theories and claims, they're each separately suing, and the pocket of money that's available is limited. And, Kobe Bryant's, net worth is $600 million, and his loss of economic earning power is so great that you can make a really strong economic, case for Vanessa Bryant's damages to be much greater than maybe even all of the other plaintiffs' decedents combined. It really does create an issue of fairness and equity, and it places the different plaintiffs potentially in conflict with one another, or at least in conflict with Vanessa Bryant.
Yeah. So what I've heard from my various channels, and don't quote me on this, it's nothing confirmed, but mm-hmm. that the insurance policy that was applied to this helicopter was in the ballpark of, we'll say, $25 million. We'll say right around there. That normally would be sufficient for anybody flying a flying private, right? Dan, God forbid, I got in a plane and an air helicopter and I passed away. My wrongful death case is not going to be worth $20 million, even though I might think the world of my potential earnings in this possible world. Then maybe someday I'll strike it rich. But $25 billion is usually enough to cover someone's life. As insane as that sounds, that's just the way cases work out in this country. If there's no pain and suffering, if you pass away instantaneously, that's the type of valuation on someone's case. It's going to be in the low seven figures. So as crazy as it sounds, $25 million is usually enough to cover it. Now here, Dan, Vanessa Bryant's lawsuit is seeking hundreds of millions of dollars. That was the quote. We'll see how much they're actually going to get. But Dan, to answer your question, why are Vanessa's relatives, Kobe and Johnny, getting more attention than the rest of the surviving? Because those two alone, right? Or maybe if you just say Kobe alone, they have enough to bankrupt all of the companies involved. So I think, I understand why they're getting more attention.
Well, in a sense, sort of a rising tide lifts all boats, and the equities and the sympathies in the case in favor of Kobe and Vanessa, could redound to the benefit of all the other plaintiffs. I mean, this is a case that's not going to be dismissed on a motion for summary judgment, and there would seem to be a real public relations motivation, at least on the part of the defendants or their insurers, to try to settle this case much more expeditiously than in the normal course. But when you're looking at a $25 million policy and nine victims, one of whom is Kobe Bryant, I mean, how do you sort of allocate or apportion all that? And Dan, I want to get back to your earlier point. I wouldn't sell myself so short. $25 million may not be enough for someone of your youth and future earning potential, particularly if we are ever able to take conduct detrimental to a higher level and maybe monetize this someday. But $25 million is not a lot in a multi-defendant case. So settle all those claims?
Right. And also, this is important. There maybe is an issue of insufficiency of funds, because Kendall Jenner, I know, was flying those reports that she was flying on that same airline, and Kawhi Leonard. So, obviously neither, maybe Kendall Jenner is probably Kobe Bryant wealthy, so that's definitely an issue. So, that being said, the other defendant that's not included, which also might be included later down the line, the helicopter manufacturer, the distributor, there might've been issues in the helicopter. So, I'm going to fast forward everybody.
But the story keeps changing. I mean, I think the theory of the case is that the helicopter pilot made a decision to fly into a fog. I mean, could it be both the fog, the decision-making of the pilot, and the manufacturing defects associated with the helicopter? I mean, it can't be any and all of those things. It has to be one of them. And, in the absence of, I guess, a national, Transportation Safety Administration, board, report, we're dealing in an information vacuum in terms of assessing fault. But I think that might be one of the reasons why the manufacturer of the plane hasn't yet been sued or named as a defendant, because I think the theory is, isn't it helicopter pilot error, you know, pilot negligence?
I mean, there's a couple of theories, but just so, you know, for those that are kind of new to this, as a plaintiff, I've never practiced a plaintiff's attorney, but I've done enough defense work. The goal is to throw a lot of things at the wall and see what sticks after you run through discovery. So I know, because, you know, this is probably a good segue here. So number one, you could claim that it's hella pilot error. You could claim there was an issue with the weather system and flying into weather. So part of this lawsuit is that the terrain awareness weather system, or whatever you want to phrase it, I've heard it, you know, used it in a couple of different contexts, that this helicopter was not, it was not mandatory to have this equipment on the helicopter. I believe the helicopter is an early 1990s model. There was no recall, right? Sometimes we get on our cars, I have a Jeep, we got recalled. I had to go, fix something on it. The brakes had to be fixed. No recall on these helicopters, no black box. So we don't really know what happened to this helicopter. So, not so long ago at this point, June 18th, I apologize. Vanessa Bryant is introducing legislation to hopefully be passed. And she's introducing a bill called the Kobe and Gianna Bryant Helicopter Safety Act. So people can say, you got to take my word for it. There were people in my replies saying Vanessa Bryant's just chasing money. It's all about the money for her. If it wasn't about the money, she wouldn't have sued. She wouldn't deal with this. But if you're going as far as the proposed federal legislation, I'm going to say it's not about the money. You're really trying to enact change and trying to make helicopters safety. I mean, in a much safer place. Obviously, Dan, in a world that we were in January and February of 2020, we were worried about helicopters being safe. It's a very different world than we're in now with this COVID 2020. But it is what it is. But I think it's pretty safe to say that Vanessa is doing this to try to enact a bigger code. So Dan, now I kind of want to make our transition to our topic where we're at. So what we've seen in these last, it's probably like 9 months at this point, right about eight months. Vanessa Bryant has sued and said, I'm suing for hundreds of millions of dollars. And, I'm seeing people on Twitter, I don't mean to make light of it, but get it. They're saying get her queen, go after him and go get him into bankruptcy. And she follows something like that up with, this lawsuit that we're going to talk about, suing the LA County Sheriff's Office for disseminating pictures and taking illegal, impermissible pictures of Kobe Bryant and the other remains of victims at the site. She's suing them. And then there's a story that comes out, and it's not really necessarily tied into all this, but, I want to bring it up because as an LA County juror, you just kind of have to be mindful of the whole story of Vanessa Bryant. There's a story that's coming out today. It's probably, within the past 48 hours, Vanessa Bryant has allegedly, we'll use the term allegedly because we don't know for sure, but thrown her mother out of the house and asked for a car back that she gave her. And now they're kind of having a split. And Vanessa has this big statement that she says, I don't want my public, my personal dealings aired. I want it to stop here. So, Dan, I'm going to phrase it to you like this, because I think this is kind of an interesting just legal time. I didn't really know that much about Vanessa Bryant prior to any of this. And now, obviously, she's the center of this whole ordeal in a positive way. She's trying to enact positive change. But, when you're in the spotlight comes maybe some additional criticism. So, Dan, we'll try this out. I know you're a man of New York and now from Florida. Let's pretend you're a, Beverly Hills Dan. How do you think your perception of, of Vanessa Bryant has changed? Do you think that you're capable, if I'm, doing some voir dire, do you think you're capable of being an impartial juror?
Yeah, sure. And I think I'd rather be, given my background in, growing up in New York City, I think I'd rather be Manhattan Beach Dan, if we're going to, pick a California.
That was not part of the hypothetical. You're Beverly Hills Dan.
Vanessa Bryant's, behavior is not even remotely an issue in any of these cases. She's suing in a representative capacity as a, the administratrix or administrator of the estate, as his wife. Her actions and her reputation and whatever her, her relationship is with her mother and any perceptions, none of that is even remotely relevant. I don't believe it would come up or be remotely discoverable material or admissible at trial. So, for people like you and me who see all this litigation conduct, it does create an image in my mind of someone who unhesitatingly uses the court system swiftly quickly and aggressively. But for the average LA juror, I think the fondness and love of Kobe Bryant will overshadow and overwhelm any potential downside associated with maybe the perception that Vanessa, you know, Bryant has a tumultuous relationship with her mother. I think that's neither in here nor there, and it's classic TMZ, New York Post, grist of the mill, and it has absolutely no relevance or real world impact on how these cases play out.
Yeah, so I bring it up for an important reason, and then we're gonna head over to the new topic. The Kobe wrongful death case has really not really gone that far. No depositions, anything like that. But what has happened, which at least is of note, there was a motion to transfer venue filed by the pilot's estate. Obviously, he passed away, but to move the case out of LA County jury because the allegation was, of all places on the face of this earth, that LA County of all places was going to be the least partial. They were going to be unfair towards and favor Vanessa Bryant. So, you know, in theory, right, as a jury, you can write a blank check for whatever recovery you want. So that was the thought process. And they filed a motion to change venue. Vanessa Bryant filed what's called legal opposition. And she basically said, Kobe is so big that there is no place, you know, it doesn't matter. He's an icon, international icon, citing different statues being built of him in, you know, across the country from China to Italy, all over the world, that you need to actually, if you're going to just strip that down about favoritism and who's going to be biased and whatnot, that LA County, Los Angeles County makes the most sense because that's where we live. That's where we grew up. That's where, and in the law, something called form non convenes. You got to pick the venue that makes the most sense for the action. And, you know, for better or for worse, LA County is the one that makes the most sense. So I understood the defendant's argument there. It's a very similar one that was made in the Boston bombing case not so long ago. And that was taken up on appeal because the case was actually kept in Boston, which you would think maybe that's the only place it shouldn't be. Same type of argument. But the case was kept in Boston and the case was kept in LA. So, Dan, let's put a pin in that.
I want to just get back and focus on the motion for change of venue. Those are rarely granted. And I think this one in particular, I don't know if it's been ruled on yet, but from my lens, it has a 0%, and zero is not a number, but it has a 0% chance of getting granted.
If I told you it has been ruled upon and it was denied?
Okay, good. And then, you know, I'm so good at my predictions. I don't even know the result. I don't know the outcome. And then my predictions after the fact still ring true. But these
Dan,
tend to
just
be,
like Kevin Warren, I don't believe you, but go on.
But the motions for transfers of venue really are more appropriate in a criminal setting than they are in a civil or commercial litigation. I mean, I can't think of any case civilly where I've seen a motion like that requested or granted. And this, you know, obviously is a whole high profile case, but in the internet age, the publicity surrounding this accident and the death and the love for Kobe Bryant transcends Los Angeles County. It's not the locus of it isn't just LA County. I think it's throughout California and probably, you know, nationally. So there's no escaping the publicity surrounding this lawsuit. And as a civil case, it really had no shot of being granted.
So, okay. So let's take this moment, for purposes of people, that's our background section. So now, you know, as much as you need to know.
That's a background. Kobe. That's a whole episode, Dan.
Dan, guess what? We're not done yet. Okay. We didn't get to the heavy hitting legal analysis people signed up for.
I love the throat clearing for half an hour. And then we really
that
get
was
into
not,
the meat of it.
That was not throat clearing. That was Dan, I write my own briefs. I write my summary judge motions. I have the deposition testimony I throw in. I throw in the facts presented. We got to lay a foundation. Okay.
Well, we're burying the lead because I think
burying the lead. Okay. This is the Vanessa Bryant episode. We gotta lay a proper foundation. Okay. So now let's put a marker right here. Boom. Okay. Now this takes us to the week of September 21st, depending on when you listen to this. The part of the story that we left out at some point, immediately after the crash happened, the LA County Sheriff's Department or the sheriff over there spoke to Vanessa Bryant and said, I'm going to personally make a personal guarantee that this crash scene will not be tampered with. There will be no photographs taken of any remains, and we're going to treat this very sensibly. So he apparently made some personal allegedly, of course, personal assurances to Vanessa. Vanessa was really taken and really happy with that conversation, and they went their separate ways. The next time we hear of anything about this crash site or photos being taken, a local bartender in California overhears a sheriff's deputy talking to a female patron at the bar and basically kind of bragging, hey, look at these pictures I took or that I have from the Kobe crash site, and showing off the pictures. We probably would never found out about it, but for a good Samaritan bartender who filed a complaint and made this thing public. And the allegation is that the police never told Vanessa or any of the survivors, the surviving family members, that these photographs were taken, that Vanessa and everybody else just found out about it with this kind of whistleblower bartender. So there was a claim filed against the LA County Sheriff's Department back in May, not an official lawsuit, but kind of a heads up that a claim was going to be filed. And now today, the week of September 21st, we have that lawsuit filed. So in the lawsuit, essentially, Dan, I'm going to turn it over to you for your expert legal analysis. But the claim is essentially saying, for better or for worse, it's an invasion of privacy claim. You made a promise, you made an assurance that something wasn't going to happen, and guess what? It did, and it's harmed me. So they're seeking punitive damages among compensatory damages. But it's really a kind of going at your throat. It's kind of a and people are quote dropping in my replies, telling Vanessa to go get them, and that it's disgusting. Which Dan, if it's true, it is disgusting. So Dan, you break it down. I know we talked offline, but give me your thoughts overall on your impressions of this.
Well, I mean, I have a lot of thoughts about this. Number one, this is Los Angeles County. Vanessa Bryan is suing the Los Angeles County and Los Angeles County Sheriff's Office. So she's going to be asking a jury to basically award damages against themselves because the damages that are paid by the county are really, funded by taxpayer money. So on one level, that's an optic that I think of, that it might be somewhat of an uphill battle. But in reality, I think there's a lot of enmity against law enforcement and against this particular sheriff's office. So I think I don't think the jury pool will be contaminated against Vanessa Bryan. I think quite the opposite. The sympathies and the leanings are going to be towards Vanessa and Kobe Bryant and against the sheriff's office. But when you mention the bartender, the first thing that comes to mind, I mean, he was basically the whistleblower. If this were like a qui tam lawsuit against the federal government, the bartender would be able to get a percentage of the recovery for blowing the whistle on government waste or government, corruption. In this case, the bartender, he'll be lucky to get a tip, much less a qui tam recovery. But I think what's lost in the analysis, or at least the reporting of this lawsuit against the LA County Sheriff, is that it's not quite the slam dunk that I think most people would, intuitively think it is, because we all would agree that the taking of these photos showing the bodies and the crash scene, and then displaying those photos, to friends or in public establishments, is so far beyond the pale that no one can question that there should be liability here. But the tortfeasor, the primary tortfeasor in this case,
But let's talk about what the tort is. First of all, it's invasion of privacy, right? I mean, we don't want to bury that. I mean, there is an actionable tort for invading someone's privacy in a harmful and malicious way.
No question. But okay, it's invasion of privacy, negligent infliction of emotional distress, negligent supervision and hiring, all these torts or all these causes of action. I think you can really make a strong case against the individual sheriff's deputies who committed these torts, who invaded, the privacy and caused all this emotional distress. But they're not the deep pockets, right? I don't even know if they've been sued. I've yet to see a copy of the complaint, none of the stories. And by the way, that's a pet peeve of mine. TMZ has received a copy of the complaint, or Daily News has, learned, we've seen a copy of the complaint. Nobody ever links to it. That is like one of my pet peeves, that if you're going to report on the story and you're going to break the news of a lawsuit, why don't you just provide a link to the complaint? So on this first day of the reporting around Vanessa Bryan's new lawsuit, I have yet to see a copy of the complaint. But what I have learned from the reporting is that the defendants appear to be the entities, Los Angeles County, the Los Angeles County Sheriff's Office, and the sheriff, I think his name is Alex Villanueva. And the one issue or the one barrier that just sticks out for me is sovereign immunity. And, you know, I understand you sue the sheriff's deputies directly. They're the ones who committed the tort. Their implementation of the, you know, their low level actions at the staff or operational level definitely would give rise to an actionable claim. But when you seek to impose, you know, municipal liability on the sheriff in his official capacity or the sheriff's office, you're then getting into issues or potentially issues of sovereign immunity. And California has a state level immunity statute for governmental employees under Section 820.2 of the California Government Code, which basically immunizes public officials from damages and claims arising out of their discretionary policy decisions. And in weighing whether there's immunity or not, there are two types of, I guess, governmental actions. There's policy making, and then there are operational actions implementing that policy. And depending upon which level of behavior applies, could decide the immunity issue. And I think the theory of Vanessa's case is that Sheriff Villanueva is liable not because he took the photos or invaded the office's invaded her privacy, but it's that he didn't conduct any formal inquiry or investigation and simply told the officers or the sheriff's deputies that if they deleted the photos, nothing would happen, and then didn't do any follow-up to verify that or inspect the phones. And her theory seems to be that he's responsible on a negligent supervision or negligent hiring claim as sort of a municipal defendant. And for that might rise to the level of being a policy decision rather than an operational decision. So these are very high stakes. I don't think there's, you can be half, it's not half operational or half discretionary. I think that this falls into the realm, I think, potentially of being a discretionary policy decision. And if his decision not to convene an investigation falls into that category, he's immunized from liability under this state law. There is an exception to it. I think negligent supervision and negligent hiring are an exception to the public official immunity. But I think that's the issue that stands out as the most important one in the lawsuit.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I don't want to pretend I'm so familiar with Los Angeles politics, Dan and I being from the East Coast. But, you know, I'm just you do a quick Google search of Alex Villanueva, there's people calling for his job left and right, votes of no confidence that are being thrown out. He's taking a lot of heat. And I, you know, obviously it looks like he's the first sheriff's deputy, Hispanic speaking, of LA County, I think in like 100 years. So obviously there's some, you know, historical precedence to his hiring and his position. But when you're dealing with someone like Vanessa Bryant, it doesn't matter who you are. If you're not handling this properly, you know, you're going to get some heat for it. So I think, you know, Dan, I want to make sure we hit this. It's a topic that, you know, in field of law that I practice, defense work, a lot of it's investigative work. If I know that a photograph exists and I can't find it for some reason, but I know that it exists and you're not turning it over in discovery, I'm going to keep asking for it. And if you don't provide it to me, and you don't provide me an excuse of where it is in an affidavit of search, more often than not, I mean, at least I'm angling to get what's called a spoliation charge, that the photograph or whatever it is that I'm looking for is not there because you made it not there, right? Because you deleted it. So the allegation that's basically out there against Alex Villanueva and the, you know, LA County Sheriff's Department is that these photos are not there because Alex Villanueva basically said, allegedly, of course, delete the photos and you won't get in trouble. So guess what, Dan? It's really hard to prove invasion of privacy that you impermissibly showed these photographs at a bar if the photographs don't exist anymore. You know, we can talk about TMZ's good reporting, but TMZ is also sometimes in the news for bad reporting, right? They put pictures out that we don't want to see, sensitive materials that we don't want to see. I have a feeling, this is just my hunch, and don't quote me on this, but I mean, if the photos were really out, right, and they weren't truly deleted, knowing TMZ, knowing and TMZ understanding the newsworthiness of, you know, this story, I imagine the photographs would be out. So now, Dan, we're in a world, again, we're just...
They wouldn't publish those photos. TMZ, you could accuse them of bad taste. and they'd be willing to do almost anything, as any news organization in this competitive landscape would do for a buck. But I think showing the bodies following a plane crash is probably a line that wouldn't be crossed.
I'm in agreement, but what we might see, Dan, and this is just to you know, our point, and I've seen this a couple of times. Hey, we have the photographs, we're in possession of them, we're not disclosing them. I think TMZ would have gotten a hold of them one way or the other, whether or not they disclose them. People have their own opinions about TMZ. So now back to this particular lawsuit, the reason we wanted to do this podcast. If you don't have photographs, which is my God, right? The photographs don't exist. Doesn't Vanessa have a, and listen, we'll talk about the individual deputies, whoever it is. I mean, doesn't she have a huge edge? I mean, the photographs aren't there, right? Isn't that the whole case? Isn't that a spoliation charge just waiting to happen? Just pressing that big red button?
I mean, I don't know that the photographs don't exist. I think there should be a stipulation that the photographs existed. I think Sheriff Villanueva.
Think he would have any liability if that occurred, if they go on record and they say we deleted them because Alex Villanueva told us to?
Well, there are some sanctions that would be appropriate for that. For example, if you didn't produce them in discovery, now they haven't been discovered yet. It's possible that those photos can be retrieved from, you know, from cell phones, that there may be some manifestation of them somewhere that the sheriff's county, at the sheriff's office and the individual defendants, if there are individual defendants, would be able to produce that or at least admit to it in a request for admission or some type of document. But the consequences associated with spoiling the evidence or exfoliating the evidence usually comes down to the judge will strike your defenses, not allow you to present a certain defense because you destroyed the evidence. So I think it doesn't amplify the damages, so to speak. What it does do is give the court a significant leeway and discretion in imposing a procedural sanction against the defendant who exfoliated the evidence that would make it more difficult to defend the case.
I have another one for you, Dan, because this is I did municipal work for briefly over at Nassau County Attorney.
For a guy in his early 30s, you're like a true Renaissance man. You've worked for the Giants. You've done insurance work. You've done municipal work. That's pretty impressive in this, in relatively the sort of the front nine of your legal career. I'm quite impressed.
We'll say the front seven of my legal career, but who is counting?
You're on the fourth hole.
Yeah, something like that. Okay. No, but I wanted to at least bring it up. I mean, Dan, I remember that the
it's a par five.
It's a par five. It's a par. We can have fun with golf terms, okay. But I mean, you know, I'm going to probably mess up the actual term. Some municipal lawyer somewhere on the millions of listeners of this podcast is going to call me out for it. But as a governmental actor, you have immunity for acts that occurred that are in furtherance of your job that you take within that role. Mm-hmm.
Great point.
I don't know if, right, deleting, hey, guys, delete the photos so you don't get in trouble with your job. I mean, I don't really know if that's in furtherance of any type of official duty, right? What did that, if anything, that's kind of harmful to your job, right? If there's in some type of investigation, it seems like he was almost giving them that olive branch as a kind of a favor. It has nothing to do with his duties as sheriff. It seems like it's actually in contravention to his job.
Well, I would say doing your job badly doesn't necessarily place it outside the scope of your employment. I think when we look at
but how would that be in furtherance of the job? Telling people to.
I think you might be conflating the two.
There is the intentional tort business that I'm kind of graying in between, but I just governmental function immunity.
I think he made a really poor policy decision here of deciding. That his way or his the policy that he was implementing was instead of doing a true investigation, he would try to convince the officers to undo the harm, which is a really despicable decision.
Not sure the harm is undone.
Definitely not. But I think he was acting within the scope of his employment, but. I would say that the sheriff's deputies were clearly acting within the scope of their employment when they took these photos, but when they released them and disseminated them at the bar, they were certainly outside the scope of their employment. And, on that measure, maybe the sheriff's office can separate or at least distance themselves from the officer's actions off duty that were not within the scope of their employment. And in that case, maybe the respondeat superior chain is broken.
So I'm gonna push back on you, Dan. This is an honest question.
It's a great debate. I mean, these are fascinating issues, all without the benefit of the complaint.
In what world, right? You know, in my Renaissance world, Dan, of my Power Five or however analogy, I've never worked as a cop. But in what world would a sheriff's deputy, who is not a medical examiner, right? They're not doing the autopsy report. Why would they need to have the photos? And Dan, I'll go one step further. If the photos can be so, hey, don't ask any questions. We're going to delete the photos right away. Just give us your phone and we'll delete them. That tells me that those photos were not essential to their job. If we're just going to delete them, right? It's another argument if you say, these photos were really important and we need to save them and document them. So you just have to tell us which photos are out there. It seems like they very much took those outside the scope of their employment, in which case, you know, then you may be looking at more liability. If you could just, so again, we're all on the assumption Phil Nuova actually told them delete them. I think that's almost, you know, pretty strong evidence that this was not part of their job description. If they could be so easily deleted, right? And the medical examiner who was preparing the autopsy report, I'm sure, as this was going on, if they didn't have those photos, right, and they weren't fully documented, they weren't bait stamped, whatever the equivalent of that is, I think that's pretty strong evidence that these were not taken in the scope of employment and they were just taken for, you know, a memento. I don't know what kind of sick person would need a photograph of a crash site, but that's, I think, what happened.
Yeah, Dan, I wouldn't give up the hope or eliminate the possibility that you'll be able to, you know, work as a cop. I think you could play a cop. I could see you on Law and Order Special Victims Unit. You definitely have the hair for it. So, if you ever have an opportunity to go to a casting call, I could definitely see you as the young, you know, district attorney or assistant district attorney who's going to work with the police department and prosecuting.
And this is what we're doing right now. We're auditioning. And by the way, quick shout out for those that haven't watched our show on YouTube. You can see Dan's beautiful Capitol shirt that he almost put on, decided not to put on.
Yeah, it didn't make it. Here's my Capitol shirt.
And
there's a story behind the shirt, Dan.
Nobody asked you about the story behind the Capitol shirt. Just so we're keeping score here.
I want a name drop. It was the day that I met Ted. I had a meeting with Ted Leonsis at the Capitol One Arena.
That is the owner of the Capitals and the Wizards. The Wizard.
Yep. He invited me into a meeting, and it was like one of the greatest days that I've ever had in terms of business meetings. He's one of the most fascinating individuals and a great guy. And that was a memorable day. And I bought the T-shirt. He didn't give it to me for free. I actually went to the souvenir store at the Capital One Arena, which is now like right next to a real sports book at the Capital One Arena. And I bought the T-shirt. So anyway, we digress.
Well, Dan, I'm just going to I want the judge to note my objection on relevancy grounds. But, you know, we're talking about Kobe Bryant here. We can't be talking about the Washington Wizards and the Washington Capitals. So I digress.
Or Mystics.
Or the Mystics. True. Mm-hmm. Okay. Importantly, let's get kind of back to brass tacks. Let's go along with this assumption that these photographs were not taken in the scope of their employment, right? And we found some admissions, some stipulating that these photographs were not taken in the scope of employment. Do you think that the sheriff's deputies, maybe even though that they're a lesser pocket, do you think that they have culpability here?
No, they have culpability. If it's within the scope of their employment, it would certainly be considered not something for which they should get, you know, statutory immunity, because it's not, you know, a policy or discretionary decision. It's a operational low-level staff action. So if it's in the scope of their employment, they've got no immunity defense. If it's outside the scope of their employment, it's still a tort. It's still invasion of privacy. It doesn't matter. This is not a Section 1983 case where being under color of state law is one of the elements of the cause of action. This is a private tort. And the tort is committed by these sheriff's deputies, not just because they're sheriff's deputies, but because they're individuals who committed this tortious cause of action. Once you strip, or at least if you bring this outside of the realm of Section 1983, the federal civil rights statute, it's just, you know, within the scope, outside the scope, the color of state law is irrelevant. So they would be culpable whether they acted within the scope or outside the scope of their responsibilities. But the sheriff, Villanueva, brought those activities within the scope of his employment by virtue of his policy determination to deal with the investigation or to not investigate these actions. So
I'm still not sure. I just want to play devil's advocate for a second. I'm not sure that that's within the scope of his employment. Because Dan, let's say I was, we'll pretend that I'm the...
Well, it's not a scope of employment. And scope of employment is what the individual deputies did. Mm-hmm. For Villanueva, for the sheriff, the dichotomy here is this a policy-making discretionary action or decision? Or is it an operational type implementation of policy? Or is it neither? So,
I mean, listen, if immunity
turns on how you categorize.
But let me ask you this, because you seem to be well versed in.
No, I went on Westlaw for like 2 hours.
Stop telling people the magic. You are the guru. Okay, you knew this. Just you were born with this innate knowledge. You learned it by osmosis by putting your hands on blacks, and then you knew it.
I know how to spot issues, and you know how to spot issues too. And you spot the issue, and then you try to gain a mastery over the subject matter by trying to do extensive research around it. And that's what I did for this episode.
So let me ask you this: if there's a situation where Alex Villanueva basically said, "These guys are my friends. I don't want to get them in trouble," even though these photographs might be able to help the investigation and help the coroner and help the medical examiner, they're my friends. I don't want to get them in trouble. So just delete them. No big deal. And he kind of said that to him off the record. They were at the bar. You know, my wife and I have been watching Brooklyn Nine-Nine recently. They're at the bar. He just kind of tells them that offhand. Don't worry about it. We'll delete them. It has nothing to do with the job. No one will ever find out about that. Now at that stage, which seems to be kind of reasonable. I could see that potentially happening. Yeah. Is that somehow now get Villanueva back in this lawsuit, or is he still immune, do you think?
What you just described as a hypothetical, I'll put it to you this way. It would be a plaintiff's lawyer's fantasy if that were the real set of facts.
I'm trying to give Vanessa a bone here. I'm trying to give
it would be a directed verdict for the plaintiffs based on Sheriff Villanueva's negligent supervision and or hiring, mainly supervision. I mean, this is clearly what you're describing here. If he did this inadequate inquiry and basically said, just delete them off your phone. And then there was no follow-up, no inquiry, no confirmation by checking the phones. I would say that that's a textbook case of negligent supervision, which falls outside the scope of the immunity statute. So for that type of hypothetical, he would undoubtedly 99.9% be liable.
See, no one can watch me on the Zoom, but I'm making a little road with my hand. That is the path to victory to Vanessa. So I think to kind of recap, because we've gone kind of deep in the weeds in it, but I think it's important to note Vanessa did not, again, she's not suing the manufacturers. Maybe they amend them later, but she's very much going after these helicopter companies, hundreds of millions of dollars. They obviously can't support that. So helicopter companies probably going out of business. It looks like from the nature of this lawsuit, it's designed to get people to lose their jobs, be it the sheriff's deputy, or if it's all the way at the top, Alex Villanueva, you know, the county sheriff. So, you know, again, as an LA County juror, you're watching this. It's all in the news. I watched this great documentary on the Casey Lee Anthony case down in Florida. The jurors were very much following every aspect of that case and following her, obviously, in a negative light, very different case. And I recommend everybody watch this documentary on Hulu. It's excellent examination of a trial down in Florida. But we might disagree on this. I think that LA County jurors, there are some, and I'm seeing people from Los Angeles that are getting, that might get turned off by someone that's being extra litigious. I think, you know, Vanessa's rating is a Q rating, whatever you want to call it, was 100% around the time of Kobe's passing. But I know because I see him in my replies, it's not that many people, but there's a handful of people that are getting turned off by the additional lawsuits, right? It's terrible that your husband passed away, which the estate was worth $600 million. Now you turn around and you want to sue for hundreds of millions of dollars. You're suing the LA County sheriffs, right? There's some people that defend cops and firefighters and want to see the municipality do well. Maybe they're turned off by that. And again, we could say it's not relevant to sports law, but it's relevant to an LA County jury. You know, my wife and I were talking about it. You throw your mother out on the street, you know, so I feel this way, but I think it's important. You have to see the whole picture when it comes to these lawsuits. So, Vanessa's obviously seeking monetary damages, right? She's seeking punitive damages against LA County. So I just want people to put a pin in this. All of this is part of a picture that a jury looks at. Jury is going to look at everything about you. That's what they talk about in voir dire. They're going to talk about everything. They want to figure out what people have good relationships with their mothers. So kind of minute is that. So,
but they won't learn about this because the judge will not permit any line of inquiry. So you would have to have the expectation that.
But they're going to know about it from the reading the paper. Maybe they're going to be disqualified from having known a little bit about the case.
A year and a half from now, if this case ever goes to trial, and by the way, most of these cases settle. I would expect this case to settle. You don't think it will go to trial, or you don't think it will settle?
I don't think it'll go to trial. There's not enough money.
I agree with you. Yeah. I agree with you. Because I think the sheriff's office realizes that, you know, they committed a grievous error here. And I don't think there's any running away from their responsibility here. So this is set up, I think, to make a settlement offer in the low seven figures. No brainer if you're L.A. County. However, I think Vanessa Bryant wants her pound of flesh. You or I, or you know, the average or typical plaintiff or the administrator for the decedent's estate would take the $2-3 million settlement offer and run with it. But Vanessa Bryant, who has a net worth now of at least $600 million, she's looking to make a point. And I'm not so sure that she's willing to take a settlement offer in the low seven figures, because if she wanted that, I would think
there's no
chance she takes it. I think there's a chance it would be offered.
It's probably an offer. They probably already offered the full policy limits. I mean, what do they have to lose?
Yeah. So this may go on for a while, but a year and a half from now, whenever a jury is impaneled, if a jury is ever impaneled, I don't think they're going to look back a year and a half and remember the New York Post article where Vanessa's mom was like evicted from the house. I mean, that's going to fade in our collective memories within a couple of weeks, unless there's a lot more that comes out about the relationship between Vanessa Bryant and her mother. I just think it's neither here nor there in a lawsuit that's being brought in a representative capacity. This is not Vanessa Bryant in her individual capacity. It's Vanessa Bryant as administratrix or executrix for the estate of Kobe Bryant. Although maybe she's suing in her own name in the invasion of privacy.
I think it's I don't know what the term is in California, but pecuniary damages, loss of earnings to the household. So
I retract that part of it.
I want to just put it on people's radars. I don't actually think this is necessarily going to get to this level, but you know, at a certain point, if you're suing and you're saying you're grieving and you lost your husband and there's a lot of stuff that you can't do, you've put yourself in the middle of this lawsuit. So there can be, and I've had the, we'll say, misfortune. I don't like deposing widows, but as a part of a defense attorney, in a bigger case, sometimes you have to ask those questions about how much money you're alleging is lost, right? How much is in the household? So by filing the lawsuit, you've opened yourself up to the lawyer's questions, and I saw Vanessa's statement in response to mother. She goes, I don't want any more of my personal business being aired out. So, you know, there is a defense attorney, everyone needs an attorney on either side. Obviously the pilot's attorney, pilot's got to have a hire an attorney to defend the case. The pilots look grasping at straws. Maybe they're leveraged in, and as crazy as it sounds that they have any leverage, is that they won't ask, if they settle the case early, they won't ask a deposition and pry into her personal life. The thought came to my head the second I saw that statement, that's now something as a defense attorney, you'd say, wow, if they allow me to ask a deposition, I'm going right into that area, which is disgusting, but that's...
I'll tell you what, Dan, as to that point and digging in to her motivations or her behavior, I would just quote, as the legendary pharmaceutical expert and biology teacher Walter White once famously said, tread very carefully when you go there. This is a jury pool that will be turned off if Vanessa Bryant is cast in a villainous
or
negative light.
I remember this. Now we're on this. It's a great, great topic. The Aaron Andrews lawsuit from a couple of years back at this point. I remember that the hotel. So for those that don't remember, there's a voyeurism case that there was a peeping Tom in Aaron Andrews' hotel room. And she was basically alleging that the hotel did a negligent job allowing some perv to get the room next to her and drill a hole in the wall. And basically the guy called up and asked, what room is Aaron Andrews staying in? And then the guy got the room and drilled a hole in the wall, whatever he did.
He went to jail for that.
When you would know. that part of the defense, which was sickening, but again, you have to, as a defense attorney, you have to, if you're grasping at straws, they don't want to settle a case, you got to try to do something. Basically argue that Erin Andrews was asking for it, right? Because of how pretty she is, and somehow she was asking for a peeping Tom to, you know, peep a hole in her wall and a video be taken of her. And that got the hotel chain, I remember, hit with huge money in punitive damage. I remember that was the big portion of that case. So treading lightly, Dan, and to quote, it was a great quote from Walter.
Yeah, oh man, you corrected me. Thank you so much. I was dying to get back into it. I said, tread very carefully. The actual quote from Breaking Bad is tread lightly.
I heard tread lightly. I mean, I just
did. I say it. Tread lightly? Okay. Did you watch it? I've watched that series enough times. I've been binge watched it several times over. I should have memorized and committed that quote to memory.
I wouldn't be surprised if you had a little Walter White in you, Dan. No, I mean it. And I feel like, you know, I never know where you are. You could be in South Carolina. You could be in New Mexico driving your RV around. I don't really know what you do. I just see you on once a week for the podcast. I don't know what you do the other 6 days.
I could tell you that I'm not walking around wearing my tidy whitey white boxer briefs. So
it's because you're driving around in the RV, Dan. It's because you're not walking around anywhere. You're getting the transportation.
You know, the closest I have an SUV, but an RV, no, I'm not quite sure. So some mysteries are going to have to remain unsolved and unknown. And I prefer to have, you know, this aura of not knowing what I'm doing on my off hours. But really, you got to tread very lightly if you're going to try to impugn the character of a grieving widow in a case that involves such a beloved figure as Kobe Bryant. If that were done at a trial, you'd lose the jury.
That's a strategy to try to force an early settlement. But if that ever got to a courtroom, that's not going to go well. So, Dan, I think do you have anything else to add before we put it?
Yeah, I think one last thing. If we're going to move on, let's move off the Kobe Bryant litigation. We probably should have devoted an entire episode to this, the passing of Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg. And you might be asking, well, what's the sports law tie-in? Putting aside the issue of sports law, she was a legendary, legendary figure in the law, a pioneer, you know, one of the first female Supreme Court justices. She was a trailblazer in almost every respect, and she fought vigorously for women's rights. I mean, she is truly a historic figure, but she does have a sports law connection.
What is that sports law connection, Dan?
Okay, back in 2018. She was one of the dissenting judges in the Murphy versus NCAA case, the lawsuit that overturned the Professional and Amateur Sports Protection Act. PASPA was overturned in a majority opinion written by Justice Alito on the basis that this federal ban on state-authorized sports betting intruded upon states' rights in violation of the 10th Amendment. She wrote a dissenting opinion in that case, and if Justice Ginsburg's opinion had been the majority opinion, I basically would still be at my old law firm. I wouldn't have my own firm focusing on sports betting law. So I suppose I shouldn't be thankful to Justice Ginsburg for that opinion. But it is notable that she played a role in the sort of the most, probably one of the most important gambling cases ever to reach the Supreme Court. And several years earlier, in a very well-known Voting Rights Act case called Shelby versus Alabama, she wrote a dissenting opinion in that case in which she suggested that perhaps the Professional and Amateur Sports Protection Act, which was later overturned a couple of years later, perhaps that law runs afoul of the equal sovereignty doctrine on the basis that it treats states differently. And for a while, a lot of, you know, scholars in sports law and people who are following this case were kind of seizing upon Justice Ginsburg's footnote in the dissent as perhaps an indication that PASPA's days were numbered, albeit under the equal sovereignty doctrine and not under the 10th Amendment anti-commandeering principle. So if you're a Supreme Court justice for that length of a period of time, you're going to preside over cases that impact sports law. You know, you have the American Needle case. You have all these important sports law controversies that reach the Supreme Court. And the justices, obviously, as one of nine, play a very important role in how these laws evolve or are overturned or modified.
In PAPSA, in that big case, she was actually, if Justice Ginsburg had her way, you would still be an appellate lawyer. And
I was there.
For a period of time, you were not a fan of Ruth Bader Ginsburg. You were very much against her.
I didn't disagree necessarily with anything she wrote. Listen, she played a role in this case, and the decision pretty much broke down on party lines. I think most of the Republican justices voted to overturn PASPA, and the liberals, such as Ginsburg. Oh God, I'm at a loss. I think three voted to uphold the federal law. Six voted in favor of overturning it. I was in the court that day. I was there as a member of the media. I had a media pass through my work for Forbes magazine. For Forbes, I'm still an online contributor, and now you're an online contributor. And on the basis of my affiliation with Forbes, I got a press pass. But where did the Supreme Court place me? I was all the way in the back. The press row in the U.S. Supreme Court was behind these Roman columns. The last row, I only saw, I think, one justice. All of them were blocked by the columns that I was sitting behind. And I think I got a glimpse of Ruth Bader Ginsburg when I peered my head forward. But I think the only justice that I really had a plain view of was Justice Gorsuch. As the most junior justice. And the lesson learned from that day is if you're a member of the Supreme Court bar, screw the press pass. You get a better seat if you wait on the lawyer's line as a member of the Supreme Court bar. And I remember that day, Ryan Roddenberg, a fellow sports law attorney, he wasn't there covering the case as a member of the press, although he wrote about it, I think, for ESPN, but he went there as a member of the Supreme Court bar. He got there at 6 a.m, waited in line for an hour or two, and had like the equivalent of like fifth row center seats for Springsteen, whereas I was in the blue seats of Madison Square Garden. So that's my memory of that day, and it is the one and only time that I've been within, you know, remote eyesight of Ruth Bader Ginsburg, and may she rest in peace. And we're about to go into probably the most tumultuous period of recent political history in trying to nominate, or at least consider the nomination of her successor during an election season.
Yeah. So just quick. I mean, I obviously went to law school. I read a ton of her dissenting opinions. I learned a lot about Ruth Bader Ginsburg in the past few days. There's a fantastic, fantastic documentary on Judge Ginsburg on Hulu. I learned a lot. Dan, maybe, you know, everyone, I tell everybody to watch it. It goes through a lot of great opinions that we learned in con law. But one that I thought was just a really fascinating story, Ruth Bader Ginsburg, obviously went to Harvard Law, and there was a period of time where her husband was also a fellow lawyer, was diagnosed with cancer. And Ruth,
Marty Ginsburg. For a while, the foremost tax law authority in the United States. Talk about a power couple.
Did not know that.
But partner at Weil Gotshal for many years. Imagine the foremost tax law authority in the country married to a Supreme Court justice.
Yeah, if you watch this this documentary, it says he was a lawyer. It says he was a partner at a firm. It doesn't really get into, it kind of paints him, and which, you know, I think is part of Ruth Ginsburg's, you know, her MO, you know, that roles in the household don't have to be so traditional. So I thought it was just a really interesting light. He was the cook, right? And apparently she couldn't cook, and the son in the documentary jokes, I still can't look at swordfish the same way after what mom did to it. But yeah, you know, it's an interesting documentary. The only kind of thing I wanted to point out, I don't look at Ruth Ginsburg and think that this is somebody that is up all night working. I think it's, you know, I don't know, maybe it's just me. I'm an insomniac. I know, Dan, you know, we're 12:05 Eastern time. Dan and I are up late. I'm probably not going to go to bed until 2 or so, but you know, that's just the way my mind works. I did not know during law school that Ruth Ginsburg, because her husband was diagnosed with cancer, she would study her, go to the library all day. She'd go home, play with her, you know, her kid, and put her to sleep for, you know, the 2 hours, 4 to 6. And then, because she had such an insane motor, she would work and study her husband's cases because he was diagnosed with cancer from 6 to 3, 4 in the morning. She would do double the work on top of taking care of her kid. And then, you know, as an adult and as a, you know, a sitting justice, she then just burned the midnight oil. So her kids were talking about how at 3, 4 in the morning, they would wake up in the middle of the night and see their mom, you know, writing opinions. So, you know, I don't know who else is an insomniac out there, but you know, there was one of us that made it all the way to the Supreme Court. So don't let anybody tell you need 6 to 8 hours of sleep. Sometimes 2 to 4 is okay. Besides, it's a great documentary, though. Highly check. Definitely check that out.
Besides her brilliance, besides her industriousness and work ethic, she brought a humanity and compassion to the role. And we won't see the likes of her on the Supreme Court for quite a while. And if ever, she's sort of the last of that breed. And she'll be severely missed. So we did one topic, but we still had our typical length of a show. But hopefully we're able to get into these topics and really explore them, you know, with some level of detail and insight. So Dan, as always, it is a pleasure to shoot the breeze with you on sports law week after week after week. And hopefully the week ahead will bring us some new cases and some new exciting sports law controversies.
Yes, Dan, likewise. So we will put this episode in the books. And as always, for updates on the latest in sports law, if you have any questions, Dan Wallach on Twitter and Instagram at Wallach Legal. Myself, Dan Lust at Sports Law Lust, and the show Conduct Detrimental is at Con Detrimental. So we will again put this episode in the books. And we will see you next week on another episode of Conduct Detrimental.